The defining voice of the 20th century, Frank Sinatra enjoyed a legendary recording career that spanned six decades.
Those fingers in my hair, that sly come hither stare, that strips my conscience bare, it's witchcraft.
Beginning with his earliest session in 1939 and culminating with his last in 1993, for his world-renowned multi-platinum duets and duets 2 albums. In celebration of Frank Sinatra's centennial year, new career-spanning collections of the entertainment icon's timeless music have been compiled. Ultimate Sinatra presents key recordings spanning the Chairman of the Board's recordings for Columbia, Capitol, and Reprise. Together for the first time, it also features previously unreleased Sinatra recordings. All or Nothing at All, recorded with Harry James and his orchestra on August 31st, 1939, during Sinatra's first studio session, leads off the tracks.
All or Nothing at All. Half a love never appealed to me. If your heart never could yield to me, then I'd rather have nothing at all.
With that star-making session, Sinatra embarked on a three-year run of nearly 100 big band recordings with the Harry James and Tommy Dorsey orchestras, followed by more than 50 years of sessions for Columbia, Capitol, and his own Reprise label. It is a great treat to welcome Frank Sinatra's youngest daughter, Tina Sinatra, to the roundtable this morning. Tina, thank you so much for being with us. What a great treat and honor to have you on the program.
Thank you, Joe, for inviting me.
Wonderful pleasure to have you on the program. It has been amazing watching the centennial year unfold, and here we are at the actual day. There have been stage shows and exhibitions and music and video and book releases. What is the family making of all this?
Dad's legacy will live far beyond our time on the earth, and that's kind of what we set out to do, to assist in any way we thought necessary to make sure that it happened. And you know what? It would have happened without us, I think. His music is, it's in the hearts and minds of human beings who have felt him emotionally since they were maybe even from very young children, or certainly at some point through their emotional development. So music lasts. I think he's kind of the leader of that pack, let's say, for lack of a better term.
I've heard you say that shortly after he passed, of course, you're grieving the loss of your father. And then you start thinking about legacy. And one of the first things you start thinking about is, well, it's 10 years till you can get a stamp.
Mm-hmm.
And that was...
We thought about that, right? Driving to his funeral, we thought about that.
Really?
Mm-hmm. You look for things. When will we be able to celebrate him? When will we begin to heal and move forward? And the first thing was the decade to come and that stamp. And I think there are something like, I don't know, 40,000 suggestions every year. The day the U.S. Postal Service team came in to meet with us, it was like Capitol Towers hoisting that flag, that banner on the 11th of December. It's same feeling.
When you have that feeling of looking at what your father accomplished and how it affects people. I guess that's the big thing of how it impacts and affects people. When did you come to terms with that fully?
I was young. I went to see him perform at the Sands in Las Vegas, and it kind of fell into place. I knew he worked hard and I knew he was on the road a lot, but I wasn't in a nightclub before that, you know. It was a revelation, actually, and it was one of the great nights of my life.
And he would do two shows in those days, right?
Yes, he would. He did two shows. All performers in the main rooms did two shows a night until I think in the early 80s some started to do the single. But, you know, when we had time with him in between those shows as kids, he'd take us into the lounges. We'd get to see lounge acts, you know, like Vic Damone. And I don't know if Tony Bennett started in the lounge, but I remember that for me was like being adult and being out later than usual at the age of seven. It was a great childhood.
It's quarter to three. There's no one in the place except you and me. So set 'em up, Joe. I got a little story I think you should know. We're drinking, my friend, to the end of a brief episode. Make it one for my babe and one more for the road.
And then seeing the spell that your father could cast over the audience, what did that mean to you, even at that early age?
I was struck by the fact he had the nerve to do it, because I was crowds were scary to me, not him. I heard myself say something on something recently, and I described the audience in detail. That impression for a seven-year-old is sticking with a 67-year-old. It had to do with their demeanor and their dress and their excitement to be in that room. It was a small room, I remember that. And they were like worshiping him. None of my friends' dads were doing that. I know that. So and knowing that throughout my life, you know, it was an honor to be his kid because of that. His place in the world was important, and I knew that. But and I like it still here. You know, we've had a lot of exposure in the last few months, and it feels like nothing's changed. People still love and adore him and dress up for him.
One of the things that I found in so many your story and so many of the other stories that you hear is that when he was recording, when he was on stage, that all of the eyes were on him.
You must have seen what I just saw, because that's one of my lines in the piece, too. How bizarre is this? Sinatra sings. That's what it was.
Yeah.
It just played on TCM. My experience in the studio came later, more in the reprise period. I was a little young to come to recording sessions at night. And we'd come after school to spend some time with him before the recording sessions started. And, you know, it's a round stack of records. It's built like a stack of records. And I remember running around in it, because you'd always come back where you started. When I got into the years where I could sit quietly in recording sessions, it was his room. Of course, it was Nelson's or Gordon's, Jenkins' room, but I don't know. All eyes were always on him. And I got a sense, looking at some footage of Dad in the studio not too long ago, that the orchestra kind of knew when he was going to stop before he did. I thought that was kind of interesting. So they must have been going from conductor to page to Frank, too, you know, and they stopped. He said, hold it. Everybody stopped. He had a fine awareness and knowledge of music, though he never learned to read music, believe it or not. But he knew when something was wrong in the horn or string section. He could hear it before anybody.
Would you talk to him about music, or was that talking shop?
No. He talked about music a lot.
Mm.
He lived music. His world was music. His life was music. And he loved to be when young singers would call and ask questions. I mean, contemporary artists of that day would reach out to him. He'd be more than happy. I remember once he, I think, called Warren Beatty and said, "Listen, Madonna." He and Madonna were going together, Warren and Madonna, and Dad said, I'm worried about what she's doing. I don't know her, but I'm here, Warren, if you mention it to her. She wants to talk to me about her instrument." And he said, "Frank, thank you. That's great." And Warren called me to tell me what he'd done. And about 3-4 months later, I saw Warren and asked if she ever called. He said, "No, she didn't." But he was counsel to a lot of people as they were becoming more and more popular and straining more and more and, you know, working more and more. They knew to call, who do I go to in New York if my voice begins to go, stuff like that. He had a great ENT in every city he ever worked in. He knew where to go.
One of the things to come out of this centennial year is this collection, Ultimate Sinatra, which presents key recordings spanning the recordings from Columbia, Capitol, and Reprise, which really is something because that's never happened before.
That's right. That was something we strive for when we, something we would work toward to celebrate the centennial. That was on our minds all the time until we could accomplish it. And when Warner Music Group, who is our partner, made a distribution deal with Universal Music International, that put the masters in the same place. I would say for Dad's sake, merging the masters, at least to Capitol and Reprise, and then the Ultimate Sinatra putting out the collection and throwing Sony into it as well. Those two things were dreams of Frank that he did not live to see. And also, seriously, Sinatra on Sirius XM, right. That would really bring him joy because it's not just Frank. It is the music, the American pop music, American songbook, and That show actually does a great deal for music in general, especially him, but all pop singers, you know, of all ages. And what's really great is the artists of today, one at a time, have done or are beginning to think about doing standard albums. And I'm grateful to them, and they know they'll be played. There's just no better music, I think.
And it was the music, and he, although your father was not shy of even at the time of trying new music and trying new things.
No, he wasn't, and some criticized him for that. I never did. I thought the later work at Reprise was wonderful, and two of my favorite albums, A Man Alone and Rod McEwen, and Watertown, you know, they were panned when they came out, and now they're considered classic FS albums, and they deserve it.
The crossing gate is coming down. I think I see the train. The sun has gone, and now my face is wet with heavy rain. The passengers for Allentown are gone. The train is slowly moving on. But I can't see you any place, and I know for sure I'd recognize your face, and I know for sure I'd recognize your face.
Remember, Dad invented the concept album in the early 54 when he came to Capitol, and those were further extensions of very much of the concept premise to tell a story with every cut, you know, with every side.
And of course, that's what he did in the songs individually as well. He told a hell of a story.
He could take a lyric like no one and put it out. That's why, regardless of what we've done right or things we didn't do, he's here musically because it's bigger than all of us, you know. It's he was good at it, best lyric interpreter on the planet, and I don't think there's a singer alive that or prior to you know, before when they were living that wouldn't say he was the best at that. He always said, "I'll listen to a new song, to the lyric again and again and again, sometimes for weeks. And when I know the words and don't have to think about them anymore, then I'll play it around in my head. I think about it. If I feel at the end of that month or three that those words are mine, then I can sing that song." And very often, you know, he'd put all that time into it, and it didn't work for him, and he'd let the song go.
Prior to his death, did he talk about the legacy? Did he talk about what he wanted there to be for the three of you, the three children, to do to preserve that? Or was that not discussed?
Oh, no, it was discussed. I was Dad's choice to step in and start running things 25 years before we lost him. I and Bob Finkelstein, my dad's attorney, we were sort of assigned it. So I got to learn it with him beside me. Nancy had a singing career. Frankie had a singing career. I was the only one left. And I had no idea what to do, except that I think inherently I understood what he would want and like and approve. And of course, for 25 years, I could get his opinion, and believe me, I did. So I was okay with Bob to take it on in 98. But I still say that with what we've done right, I believe his legacy would live anyway.
One of the things that is so beautiful to see during this centennial is the united front that the three of you have, the three children have, which is beautiful in and of itself, but it's also, unfortunately, in show business, extremely rare.
Well, you know what I find? It's rare because sometimes there's a split. We had, you know, two families going on at his demise, and right. He made sure that there would be no room for discussion. He didn't believe in business by committee. I knew he didn't think that was very good, and I know Bob wouldn't have stood for it. So it got set up really by him that it would remain with his children, and really only one of them and Bob would have to worry about it. And we kept them informed, and there are times when we were going in a direction and Nancy and Frankie weren't that happy with what we were doing. And at times we did it anyway, but not many. We always do pretty much, we live with the theory of what would Frank do, and that's mm-hmm. what we do. Also, I want to say there are great family legacy holders, keepers of the flame. I hate that term, but I guess that's what it is. There are some really talented families at that. But for the most part, I've noticed they're not, or the families have decided to sell them off to companies, branding companies. That would not do for Frank. So, the world changed too, and all of a sudden merchandising and branding in the late 90s was something to contend with, and we bucked it all the time.
And as we wrap up, at the end of the day, what you ultimately have is this incredible catalog of music.
Exactly, which would have sustained if we dug a mile deep hole and covered it over. It's that was going to live. That was my father's world, and the legacy of something that important to someone who was so good at it cannot die.
It is why I've heard so many music historians over the past few days and weeks say that's why we will have a Sinatra bicentennial and tricentennial as well.
I hope so. I think so. I won't be here, but you call me.
we'll be together probably at the same point, hopefully. Anyway,
yeah.
The collection is Ultimate Sinatra, and it's a beautiful collection. Tina Sinatra, I thank you so much for joining us on a very special day, and I thank you so much for spending your time.
Thank you, Joe, and happy holidays.
And to you, a great pleasure. Thank you. Again, Ultimate Sinatra is out, a 4-CD set of the recordings from Capitol, Columbia, and Reprise together for the first time. Also features previously unreleased Sinatra recordings.
E, 30,211, take 4.
Just in time. What's that?
Cut. E, 30,211, take 5.
Just in time, I found you just in time. Before you came, my time was running low. I was lost, the losing dice were tossed, my bridges all were crossed, nowhere to go. Now you're here, and now I know just where I'm going. No more doubt or fear, I've found my way. For love came just in time, you found me just in time, and changed my lonely life that lovely day.
You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.